Hey there, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Here's what we're looking at.
And she tells me it was an earthquake and building is shaking. She screamed, building is shaking, building is shaking.
We check in with a Chicagoan who is leading an emergency response team in Turkey following the devastating earthquake.
Who's backing whom in the race for Chicago mayor? We break down which city council members have announced their choice for mayor.
Ahead of our forum tomorrow night, a look at how the candidates differ on their messages.
Seeing things you wouldn't otherwise see in ways you wouldn't otherwise see them.
And a Chicago company that's been a model for family businesses since 1950.
Now to some of today's top stories. The mayor and Chicago Police Department have not made enough progress on implementing reforms required by the consent decree. That is according to a coalition of 26 community and civic organizations. The group, which includes the ACLU of Illinois, the Cook County Public Defender, and Metropolitan Family Services, among others, sent what it calls an urgent letter to the city expressing deep concern. It reads in part, quote, 3 years since taking effect, the latest independent monitor report and residents' accounts of policing suggest that the city's and the CPD's implementation efforts are at significant risk of shifting course in the wrong direction toward more harm, mistrust, delayed justice, and violence. The group is calling on the city and police department to work with community groups to engage residents as well as release a comprehensive data systems analysis.
A Chicago woman is receiving an undisclosed amount of money and a financial settlement with the city of Chicago. In the summer of 2020, Julie Campos was working to clean up damage at the Family Dollar store on East 79th Street in the wake of the George Floyd protests. Police body cam footage shows Officer Eric Taylor using profane language and forcibly shoving Campos before falsely arresting her. Last spring, she filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city for a violation of her constitutional rights. Though the details of her settlement are not public yet, any amount higher than $100,000 must be approved by city council. Officer Taylor is no longer with the Chicago Police Department.
Neighbors in the south suburbs could see smoke for miles after a huge fire swept through a large commercial warehouse in Chicago Heights. The fire department there received the alarm just before 6 a.m. and had it extinguished around noon. The warehouse is owned by the company Morgan Lee, which manufactures commercial fixtures, furniture, and graphics. There were no injuries, and the cause is unknown to this point. The company says it will try and rebuild.
A little bit of Hollywood is coming to the South Shore neighborhood. The mayor, along with community and business leaders, broke ground on the new Regal Mile Studios Campus 1. It's a privately funded $100 million media campus with film studios and sound stages. One of the partners in the venture is Derek Dudley, producer of the comedy series The Chi on Showtime. Officials with the project say they hope to have the facility up and running by the fall of 2024.
Chicago civic and business leaders are mourning the death of Civic Federation President Lawrence Massol. Massol was regarded as one of the city's foremost watchdogs on municipal finance and budgeting. He served as president of the nonpartisan Civic Federation for 21 years, where he routinely analyzed the budgets of just about every government agency you can imagine. He also worked with political leaders to help solve budget shortfalls and was very vocal about fixing the city and state's chronically underfunded pension systems. Massol died on Saturday from complications due to heart surgery. He was 61 years old, and I'll have a few more reflections on Massol later in this program.
That is heartbreaking news.
Absolutely.
Lawrence will be missed.
Absolutely.
Coming up in the program, what's working and what's not when it comes to messaging in the race for Chicago mayor.
But first, the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria and how a local resident is helping efforts overseas. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Emergency relief efforts are in full force in Turkey and Syria following a deadly earthquake that's killed more than 3,800 people. Joanna Hernandez has more about a local organization assisting people on the ground in Turkey. Joanna, what do we know?
Brian, as we know, the death toll is rising. We're told these next days are crucial when it comes to the rescue operations. As you mentioned, we spoke with an organization here that's leading an emergency response team in Turkey.
Chicagoan Halid Demir says he woke up to a distress phone call from his sister in Turkey.
My sister crying and screaming and telling me, we are okay, we are okay. And that is how I learned that's an earthquake. And she tells me it was an earthquake and building is shaking.
Demir's family survived, but says that the road to recovery is long as thousands are left homeless.
It's snowing there, it's make more challenging. And due to them in the city of Birecik, that people are leaving the city, the traffic is in chaotic situation as well. So all these combined, obviously, is very serious challenge at the moment.
He runs Zakat Foundation of America, a global humanitarian organization operating locally and stationed in Turkey. The building they work from was destroyed by the earthquake.
We have a tent, so I know that we are requested our coordination with the Turkish government entities need urgently warm food. People survive. We need the hygiene kits and milk for the babies. I know that we need blankets because it's very cold and people are outside.
Rescue teams are working around the clock to try and save people trapped in the wreckage. Video shows a moment a child is rescued from the rubble of a collapsed building. The powerful earthquake registered 7.8 in Turkey and Syria early Monday morning. Devastating aftershocks have been reported as well. Demir is set to fly to Turkey tonight, where he says the priority is setting a plan to help as many people as they can. In the upcoming weeks, the organization is hoping to collect donations from Chicagoans.
We are hoping that we will open centers that people can drop if they have blankets, if they have strollers, if they have things that they might, not need in their homes. This stage, we are still only sticking to financial support. We have to look at the logistic on the ground, how we can receive the containers.
As frantic search efforts continue, Demir says the impact and trauma of such a catastrophic earthquake can take years to repair.
But earthquake is something that's so painful. The worst is that you're so helpless. That's nothing. You know that your family is under this building, but there's not much you can really do. And that's even more painful than just knowing that you lost somebody. And I ask God Almighty to protect people and give them relief. And as allow my family survive, I hope other families survive too.
We just learned from the Zagat team in Turkey that they are running into trouble because of the winter conditions. We're told roads have deep cracks on top of the icy roads, which are leading to road closures, making it difficult to move around the cities.
Such a tragic and difficult situation. Joanna, do you know how many aftershocks these countries have experienced?
And Brent, as we're told, more than 100 aftershocks occurred in the disaster areas. And then we're told victims are now seeking shelters, as we also saw in videos, are seeking shelters in their vehicles, some having to bear the winter conditions until these response teams can reach them.
Of course, a story we'll be learning more about in the days and weeks to come. Joanna, thank you so much. Paris.
Brandis, the election for mayor is 3 weeks away, and city council members are starting to pick who they want to work with during the next 4 years. Those who back the eventual winner could find themselves in powerful positions this spring. And WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now with more. So, Heather, there's the race for mayor, and then there's the race for endorsements, and then there's the race for endorsements among city council members. So who leads that race?
Well, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, as you would expect as the incumbent. But she has lost the backing of several of her closest allies, those responsible for pushing her agenda through the city council. Two powerful committee chairs last week endorsed someone else. Pat Dowell backed Cook County Commissioner Brandon Johnson, and Tom Tunney, her zoning committee chair, backed Paul Vallis. And that, of course, is putting more of a spotlight on her really combative approach to dealing with the city council, which has been in stark relief in the last couple of weeks.
Right. These were a couple of allies that went back to the beginning with Lightfoot. So there are 26 council members that have backed a candidate. That means nearly half of all their folks have not. Are they kind of trying to hedge their bets or wait until it's a safer bet, maybe?
Well, sure. We're likely to see a runoff in April, and then you'll be able to choose either or, one of two candidates. Some of the older people who haven't endorsed a mayoral candidate are retiring and are sort of receding from the stage. But four older people appointed by Mayor Lori Lightfoot running for their first full terms on the city council have declined to endorse the mayor. The mayor says that's okay. She thinks they're the right people for the job, and she hopes they get elected, even if they're not backing her.
You'd think that she would have some or most of them in her pocket. So do these endorsements really matter at the end of the day?
Well, the endorsements that matter come with volunteers or money or ideally both. But this is the kind of endorsement with Tom Tunney and Pat Dowell that can prompt voters undecided among nine candidates to take another look at Johnson or Vallis. And that, in a race that's going to be decided by just a few percentage points in 3 weeks, could make all the difference.
Heather Cerrone, 3 weeks. It's going to be three eventful weeks, I think.
It sure will.
All right, thanks very much. And you can read Heather's full story on our website. That's WTTW.com/news. Up next, analysis of the messaging in the mayor's race ahead of our WTTW News Forum tomorrow. Stay with us. Mark your calendars. As we just said, tomorrow night is WTTW's Mayoral Forum. You can stream it live online at 7 p.m. or watch at 10 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11. Our forum comes as the attack ads are flying ahead of Election Day, now just 3 weeks away. And joining us to help us cut through the messaging is Jason DeSanto, a political speechwriter and debate strategist for members of Congress and multiple presidential campaigns. He is a senior lecturer at both Northwestern University's School of Law and School of Communication. Jason, always great to see you.
Paris, great to see you as always.
All right, well, welcome to the new studio here. In a nine-candidate field, how does one use messaging to stand out?
Well, you've got to come up with a message in this kind of race which is contrasting and believable in order to stand out. Stand out on television, stand out in debates. That's why you hear so many candidates in debates say, I'm the only candidate who's ever blank, fill in the blank, is just to have something that's going to stick with people, that's going to be different than everybody else. It really comes down to math, message, and money. You've got to have the math to put together a coalition to put you over the top. You've got to have a message that's clear and contrasting and believable, and you have to have the money in order to get behind that message. That makes you stand out.
And let's assess some of the so-called top-tier candidates. Who's accomplished that so far?
I think if we had to rate on the clarity of the message and getting some money behind it, it would be Brandon Johnson and it would be Paul Vallis. I think those two have been the best so far at speaking rather clearly with what their key messages are and being able to be clear in the ads they've run and also in the debates tracking that. You want those messages to go across platforms, and they've done a good job on that. For Vallis, staking out the crime issue early on has worked for him. And in the debates, he sort of layered that a little bit with some of the more wonkish parts of his personality, with some recommendations, some bullet points. So it comes off not exactly as fear-mongering, which I think is important for some of the coalition he wants to build. And for Johnson, he's really saying something different than every other candidate on the stage so far. There's a kind of a clarity. He gets a question about police or public safety, and he's really not talking about police. He's talking more about investment. That's kind of his message. He's owned that, and he's had good clarity on that and has been quite eloquent, I think, in the debates at expressing it.
Obviously, stark ideological differences between those two, Johnson and Vallis. But I've said this all along, in a race like this, at least in the general election, it comes down to who can build a coalition, as you just said, not just one narrow group of voters, but a couple different groups. How do you create messaging that goes across the diverse sort of demographics of the city?
So persuasion's not a zero-sum game. You can speak to different audiences at the same time with different parts of your message. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it waters down your message so much that we're not sure what that message is. And I think we have some examples of that in this race. I'll give you one positive view of this, one way that a message can cut across. Vallis's ads early in this campaign, very cleanly executed ads, talking direct to camera, comes across as both, I think, with some authority and also with a little bit of humanity. The actual messages themselves are about crime, they're about accountability, and then there's this little piece right at the end of that initial commercial that talked about keeping schools open so kids have other activities. And that sounds a little bit different than the normal tough-on-crime messaging, right? So he's kind of branching across. Conversely, we look at somebody like Chuy Garcia. I think he's tried to speak to a bunch of different audiences. He really hasn't put a lot on the air yet. And also, I think in doing so, his message has gotten just a little bit muddled as to why he's running and what he's running to do.
And he hasn't been on the air so much, but there has been attack ads against him on the air. For example, Lightfoot has an attack linking Garcia to Sam Bankman-Fried and Mike Madigan. She's really brought that up at the debates as well. Do you think those things have had resonance?
They have, because he was late to start, didn't get on the air, probably was late getting back from Washington after the kerfuffle about electing the new Speaker of the House, got in late, didn't put anything on the air, then was attacked immediately. We go back to what you were talking about before, coalition building, or what I call math. If you think about his campaign, he's got strong Latino support, but what he needs is to continue to branch out into lakefront liberals, and everything that is run against him on ethics is a shot at that. That's taking voters away from that potential group for him. And if he's not up and saying anything that's positive, he has trouble building that coalition he's going to need.
So turning a potential strength into a weakness there for Garcia with all those attacks. And then with Vallis, you've got Lightfoot and Garcia painting him as a Republican, as someone who's kind of squishy on abortion rights. Do those kinds of things have resonance?
They sure can. I mean, he has had the advantage so far of not really being attacked that much. A little bit in debates, it's come up a little bit. Lightfoot went out the other day and doing some press conferences and then circulating some videos and trying to get to this issue. And Garcia has, too, about him being not sufficiently pro-choice, not sufficiently a Democrat. Now, the challenge for him is going to be in these closing weeks, now that some of these candidates maybe have more money than they have before, and now that he's at the top and will be a target, we're going to see a bunch of ads on that. In your debate tomorrow night, we no doubt will see attacks on him regarding the endorsement by the Fraternal Order of Police. And now he's going to have to stand and defend against those. When it's come up in debate so far, he's kind of shrugged it off, but I also haven't been terribly impressed with his ability to explain what his positions are in relationship to some of his allies.
Good to know what to expect tomorrow night, looking into the crystal ball. All right, so we mentioned a few names. There's other names, Buckner, King, Willie Wilson, Jamal Green, Roderick Sawyer. Anything stand out about the campaigns that they've run?
So I'll simply say, having watched several of these debates, having listened to some of the radio debates, I think the debates have been actually quite substantive, at least in telling us what they would do or say they would do, or at least kind of what their perspective is on the city's problems. The problem they have right now is time and air. I mean, there's just not enough oxygen in these debates, and they're not funded sufficiently to be able to get up on television. And the problem that they're going to have here, Paris, is we look at Lori Lightfoot in 2019. She was at about 1-2%, maybe in early January, but there was a kind of a catalyzing event that helped her to rise, and that was all the allegations about Ed Burke and the number of the candidates who were in that primary that year who had some connection to him, whether it was Bill Daley or Mendoza or Preckwinkle, and that plus her strong performances allowed her to rise.
It was a seismic event. You wonder if something like that's going to happen in the next 3 weeks. Before you go, I want to get your quick thoughts on what to expect from the State of the Union tomorrow from President Biden.
Well, I mean, I would expect that we won't exactly have a victory lap regarding what happened in the last midterms, but I think he'll probably talk about them and probably couch that in terms of the speech that he's been giving for the past couple of years about the state of democracy and protecting democracy. I would imagine it would be phrased in those terms, maybe some references to some anti-democratic forces, as he would term them, that are still in the House, and then charting a course forward. I mean, his eyes are on next year, and that year before candidates run, that is a year to get into position, to get in position.
A lot of speculation as to whether and when he'll announce his reelection campaign. So it's a busy night tomorrow. You've got our forum live at 7 to 8, which folks can stream. Then you've got the State of the Union at 8, and then 10 o'clock on WTTW, you can watch that forum, 10 to 11. Jason DeSanto, thanks for coming here and sorting all this out for us.
Thanks, Paris. Pleasure to be here.
And up next, a family business that works at a very small scale. But first, we take a look at the weather.
They say seeing is believing, and that's especially true when it comes to model making. Material models can make complex ideas easier to understand, help prove concepts, and even make history come to life. A local company has been turning ideas into reality via model making for over 70 years, and you have almost certainly seen their work in some Chicago institutions. Producer Erica Gunderson recently brought us this story. Here's another look.
We made the prototype for the pocket fisherman.
Whether it's turning an idea into reality.
On Propio, yeah, we did over 10 projects for him.
or setting a scaled-down schooner to sea.
That you're convincing the person that's looking at it that it's the real thing, shrunk.
Revealing what was invisible.
Belina has a clear skin, and you can see all their organs. And they would light up.
No matter how they tried, they couldn't find an actual person to do the same thing.
Or demystifying industry.
So every municipality that bought a water tower from Chicago Bridge and Iron got a model builder's cutout so that you could put it in the front office at the municipality and shows how the water tower works.
Model Builders Inc.'s business is in the details. The Chicago-based company has created models and prototypes of all kinds since 1950. As a teenager, MBI founder Bill Chaffee created prize-winning aircraft models. At age 21, his original design for a balsa wood glider sold thousands. After stints working for industrial giants like Chrysler and General Motors, Chaffee hung out his own shingle and soon developed a reputation for his precision work creating all manner of models. Chaffee's children, Clark, Ellen, and Hal, say their father's boundless curiosity was integral to his business.
I keep thinking of him as a Renaissance man. You know, it just, his mind was never not trying to solve a problem in some creative way.
As children, all three Chaffees spent time in the shop with their dad.
I loved hanging out at the shop. The smells and the mysteries and the things in progress.
The rules were, don't turn anything on. You know, hammers and nails and whatever you can find in scraps, that's fine. Don't turn anything on.
But it was Hal who officially joined the business in 1982.
Hal has extraordinary social connection capabilities and is able to promote the business in ways that Dad didn't have capacity for.
After Bill Chaffee died in 1994, MBI continued its work under Hal's leadership. And trade show displays, like a 6-foot-long hot dog, an 11-foot-tall vodka bottle, and a 43-foot Eiffel Tower, became a big part of their business. But anything could happen.
And a guy had tripped on the stairs with the railings that go down, and so we made the front 10 feet of it, and so they could use it in their court case.
Your average person is most likely to encounter MBI's work at places like the Museum of Science and Industry, where they did restoration work on The Great Train Story and Jolly Ball. In the Ships Gallery, MBI created a 1:24 scale model of the schooner Charlotte Anne, based mostly on old photographs.
It was a Hanson scooter, and it had a kind of sleekness and narrowness. So I worked on getting first on that part of it, and then we had to translate that into a hull shape.
It can be very difficult to make things accurate. Part of our challenges with this particular project were in creating the Charlotte Anne schooner was getting the right drawings, the scale drawings, the actual measurements of the ship itself, which doesn't exist anymore, as well as documents and photographs.
Now, Hal Chaffee is winding down MBI's work in preparation for his own retirement. Looking back at the business their father began, the Chaffees say his legacy remains in the details.
How many people come through here and look at the ships? Just being able to get a sense of things in imaginable scale, and then we can, in our own brains, kind of put it into perspective on how it really works in real life. Seeing things you wouldn't otherwise see in ways you wouldn't otherwise see them, and what impact did that have on all of those people.
For Chicago Tonight, this is Erica Gunderson.
And one last note, the Chaffees say that while their father built the business, it wouldn't have been possible without the considerable effort of their mother, Ellen, both at the shop and at home.
I know before we go tonight, early in the program, we noted the passing of Civic Federation President Lawrence Massol. I want to add a personal note. Massol was one of our go-to sources on all things related to public finance, and he was more than just a civic expert, but a friend to many of us in media, public and civic life. His zeal for responsible government was matched by his kind and affable demeanor. His death drew reaction from public officials on all ends of the political spectrum because whether they agreed or disagreed, they knew that Lawrence gave it to them straight and was just there to help. His life was dedicated to public service, and Chicago and Illinois are the better for it. And I will certainly miss our conversations about politics, life,
and our mutual alma mater, St. Ignatius, our sincerest condolences, of course, to his family. Brandis, over the years, I think Lawrence might have been the most interviewed guest on this show because of his expertise and his passion for all this.
Absolutely, probably all of us, right? Whether you're covering, you know, the city budget. I know I certainly had to talk to him quite a bit when, you know, covering Chicago Public Schools and that budget there as well. And he was just a nice guy and always easy to work with. It's stunning and very saddening when we all learned about
his death. I think that's the thing that everyone remembers most. He was just such a nice guy. And everybody, whether you were left or right, politics or media, felt like he was your friend.
And he was. He'll be missed.
Absolutely.
That is our show for this Monday night. Please join us tomorrow live online at 7 p.m. and on WTTW right here at 10.
The candidates for mayor take on critical issues facing the city in our WTTW News Forum.
And we're live from the community as residents pose questions to the candidates. And again, you can watch tomorrow live online at 7 p.m. and on WTTW right here at 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Good evening.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a proud sponsor of diversity, equity, and inclusion-focused free continuing legal education for lawyers throughout the region.